Oikos presents 15 Seconds of Strength.
Here we go. Steve's got a trunk full of groceries and no one to help him.
Oh, that's tough, Jim. Looks like a 5-trip load at least.
He grabs the first bag, the second. Bob, it looks like he's trying to do it all one trip. He shimmies the door open, steps over the dog. Oh, and he stumbles.
Oh, right into the kitchen without missing a beat. Mm. Jim, now that's a man who eats his protein-packed Oikos.
With 15 grams of complete protein in each cup, Oikos Triple Zero can help build strength for every day. Oikos, stronger makes everything better.
This week's episode is brought to you by Welgo USA's latest creature feature horror, Sting, in theaters everywhere on April 12th. Sting spins a web of thrilling terror when 12-year-old Charlotte's pet spider rapidly transforms into a giant flesh-eating monster, forcing the young girl to fight for her family's survival. Directed by Kia Roche Turner and starring Ryan Coore, Isla Brown, Penelope Mitchell, and Jermaine Fowler, brace yourself for a crazy eight-legged nightmare that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Don't miss Sting, exclusively in theaters April 12th. Hello, and welcome to Fangoria's Colors of the Dark. I'm your co-host, Rebecca McKendry, and with me is the Kane, wearing a dope-ass shirt tonight. How's it going?
I'm wearing my weird brood shirt.
The brood.
It's chipper. I'm feeling good.
You feeling
I'm
good?
I'm not tired. It's not October yet, so I'm good. Ask me in October, and it's all over.
Even when Elric gets tired and grumpy end of October, he still rocks. Yeah. So, yeah. But that said, it's spring now. And it's weird because I'm definitely a fall type of person. But there is something winter makes me sad. And I'm definitely one of those people that just gets I hate when I leave for work and it's dark and then I'm driving home from work and it's dark. And I'm just like, why even bother? Like, I just get so
depressed. Dark does suck. And I don't mind the cold, but yeah, it does suck when there's no light. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it just, it kills me. And then suddenly, like, you know, my kids are still playing outside and it's 8 o'clock at night and I have my windows open and I'm waking up and it's bright and sunny and birds are singing and I'm in a freaking Disney movie because I've got birds singing outside my window. There's just something that makes me feel so much better. So I've definitely been kind of chipper this week as well. So yeah, we'll call it spring.
I think you should tell people about the new issue of Fangoria. This is not an ad for Fango, even though we are a Fango podcast, but
well,
it's very cool
say,
that you
they,
did.
They are sponsors.
They don't need
of
to
our
be an
show.
Ad. They don't need to be an ad. They're always here.
That's our network. Thanks, Mom and Dad. Yeah. But so brand new issue of Fangoria. Just started releasing to subscribers today. This should be on newsstands within a couple of days as well. And if you turn to page 79, you will find a lovely article on the history of Dead Right Horror Trivia Night, which is the pub horror pub trivia night that I've been hosting for 10 years here in LA. If you look down at the bottom of the first page, there is an adorable picture of Elric and I hanging out together at Trivia Night. This is a couple pages long, but it details the entire history of Trivia Night, kind of how it got started with Elric at his old restaurant, Jump Cut Cafe, and kind of how it's grown, that we, you know, still average somewhere between 150 and 200 people every month. There are times that I look out over the sea of people there and I'm like, how the hell do we still do this every month? Because it's so packed, but it's such just a beautiful, beautiful community. And Jared and I started talking as we were writing this article and we were like, we wanted to tally up the number of people who have formed relationships, I mean, like got together and got married because of Dead Right Horror Trivia Night, and the number of film projects that have happened because of people meeting each other at Dead Right Horror Trivia. Like it has become this community that makes shit together. And we talked about it because Jared, my co-host for that, is in the new Mecha Ape movie coming from Sci-Fi, directed by Mark Gottlieb, who we met at Trivia. And that is kind of how like all of this shit forms.
So, and the number of divorces are just slightly less. So that's good.
Slightly less. Slightly less.
But 10 years is a long time for anything. And it is a little scary how fast 10 years goes. Like when I was young, that 10 years was 10 years. Now it's 3 years. 10 years goes by about 3 years now of adult.
I was pregnant yesterday and I was stupid pregnant the first horror trivia night. Like all the pictures of me on that very first night that we did it, I'm like a goddamn, you know, parade float walking around jump cut. And I was just
pretty damn fun. Massive. Those themed episodes, yeah. Themed ones are always fun. You guys are also revitalizing the old Instagram account for it, posting a lot of old pictures from the jump cut days. And that's just been funny to watch. And you see people just everyone's hair so dark. And it's just funny to me. But it was
none of us have crow's feet yet. But yet we're all still doing trivia. It was like very much like, oh, look, we're all 20 something. I'm spry and young.
I'm sad that it's never actually existed in a pub. Like I wanted to. I know we've had one-offs when we do conventions and stuff. But I kind of hope one day it will actually just be in a pub.
You know, we've had pubs offer to host us, but the problem always becomes that space. We are such a massive group. Like I said, 150 to 200 people per show. And as soon as we move to a pub, we can't fit that many people in. And so it's always, you know, where can we get that many people in? And I would much rather have not having, you know, open containers of beer around, but instead be able to welcome everybody, then have to start doing like a reservation system again. I much love just, you know, come as you are, you're welcome. If you don't have a team, we'll put you on a team, just come.
Maybe one time this summer, there could be like one outdoor bar, you know, you get one of those pubs that have the big outdoor space, do one special 10-year, that would be pretty fun. Just to be able to drink and play trivia. My brain works better when I do that.
No, it doesn't.
I think it does. I think one beer can fuel a brain in special ways.
You get plucky. I've seen you drunk many times, and you get plucky after one or two. Like prone to talk shit. Yeah. I don't know if you get smarter, but you definitely get prone to talk.
There were 18-year-old fights in the. Yeah, I know. I remember that.
You got in fights. I can't picture
a very Australasian thing. You know, very macho society down there.
Really, you had to get in fist fights to like prove
not
yourself.
Not about horror trivia. It was usually probably about rugby or something that I'm not even aware of. But I will say, if you don't want to see us fighting, then you should go vote for us in the Rondo Awards.
Yes!
We totally forgot. We have not plugged this at all, and I think it's about to end. Here, for anyone who's watching, here is what a Rondo Award looks like. But sadly, this is covered in dust, and it's from all the way back in 2015, which is very long ago. I believe we've been nominated, every year since then. But
every
we have
year.
Never won again. We've never won as a solo. And I think part of it's because we don't push very hard. You know,
we're not really good at self-promotion.
And winning things doesn't
we're
matter.
Not.
What matters is that you go and vote for some cool stuff. But
yeah,
it is
we're gonna keep doing the show whether we win, get nominated or not. But yeah, it's we love the idea that, you know, people would kind of champion it and vote for us.
And there's lots
us,
of cool things nominated. Hey, this goes so far back that on this award that I'm holding, we won for something called Best Multimedia Site. They didn't even use the word podcast back then.
Uh-uh.
It's only been in the last few years that podcast emerged. But anyway, I wanted to remind people because we always forget to mention that. And I think this is
and
the
we're
last month.
So grateful for whoever voted for us and nominated us. That is huge.
Last year we came runner up to Mick Garris, and that felt right because it was
That one. And I think the year before that we were runner up to or maybe it was 2 years ago. Oh gosh, I can't remember his name now. Oh gosh, it was a big show and he was a major actor and he ended up passing away and he was Iago in Aladdin and he was the bird in Aladdin.
Oh wow.
Gilbert Godfrey.
Oh yeah, Gilbert.
We lost
the amazing
to Gilbert
colossal
Godfrey.
Podcast. Yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah, we lost to him. We were runner up to him.
We've been runner up a lot.
And I was like, I'll back off if we're runner up to Gilbert Godfrey or Mick Garris, totally take it. But yeah, we would love to come in one more time. So.
But anyway, thank you for whoever nominated us for that.
100%.
We appreciate that. Well, let's start because we have a really cool guest, somebody that's always fun to talk to, and it's been years. But let's talk. I know we both saw Ghostbusters.
We did. So let's start with Ghostbusters. So we both took the kids, right?
Mm-hmm. Separate kids.
Separate kid. We went separately, but you found a few and took them along. And that's what's
maybe
important.
That's the trick to liking this movie, because I saw so much negative press initially, and especially because the last one was very beloved, I think. And then I went to this, and because the kids were really enjoying it, I really enjoyed it through that. And I did. I kind of dropped my critic. The critic part just falls away once I'm in it, and I'm having a good time.
I loved this, and I was so shocked because we saw it. I took the kids opening night, so we were there like Thursday at like 7 o'clock, the night that it opened. And then within a couple of hours of getting home, I'm seeing all this negative press about it, and I thought it was so much fun. The only thing that I even remotely bumped with, and this is a weird little quibble, I want them to stop bringing back the original cast and relying on them so much because the story held its own. It did not need the original cast. And the new cast held their own. Like, I loved them as a functional family of Ghostbusters.
Well, the one who makes sense is Dan Aykroyd. He actually makes sense in the narrative because he's running a store and he's on YouTube. Like, he feels natural to this world. When you bring back Bill and the others, as much as we all love to see these guys, that just felt like you're just kind of shoehorning them in at the end.
Yeah, it was very shoehorned. It was like we're stepping away from this really actually good plot about this ghost god who's come back and is trying to, you know, release everybody so that we can step away and see what Janine's doing now and then step away and see what, you know, Bill Murray's doing now and really kind of shoehorn them back into the narrative structure. And so it did not feel cohesive when they came into it. But that said, I loved what the new storyline was. I loved what they were doing with it. I loved the new family.
Camille Nanjiani is so funny in this. And so, well, I thought it would be the part that I'd bump with, but it totally works.
So
funny. And him as a key part of, he's almost like the key master.
Fire holder, the fire master or something like that. He was really good.
So I could handle him being part of the team. But anyway, I do hope there's more, but I think if there's more, they have to really just completely break the shackles from the IP and just, you know, go with this new family of Ghostbusters, because that's, I think, what we're all ready for it. I think you're totally right on that. But it was still very enjoyable, and it was a fun way to see that movie. And again, I think sometimes, you know, and everyone has a right to be a critic. You don't want to, but I think seeing it through the eyes of who it's aimed for really can help a movie like that.
Oh, my kids fucking loved it. It was such a good time. So yeah, that it made me love it. And I would have loved it anyway, because I thought that god was so badass. And that little device that they were using to control it really
definitely leans to the horror of those sections. They like it's one of the scary creatures. And I will say all the trailers were fine before, except one that both my kids almost had to leave the movie theater for when they showed, is it Blumhouse doing a film called Tarot? And it was an intense horror trailer. Both of them
completely covered their faces.
I don't know who it was, but
it's a Blumhouse film. But yeah, Strummer after
saying that trailer.
This is my two kids. Like, Marnie looks like covered her face, and Strummer looks at me and he goes, "Do you get invited to the press screening to that? Can I go?" And I was like, "I can't take you to the press screening."
Mine were just both hiding, and I was like, "I didn't think it made me go. Maybe these are the trailers for the night ones, cool. And during the day we play lighter." But you know, whatever. I know we're in the
minority. We'll be at the press screening for Tarot. We're going
to
get
there. I wanted to see it after that. Actually, it looked good to me.
It looks great. It looks fun. And a
high concept, easy sell for me. But we saw a couple of the same movies this week, right?
Yeah. So let's go to Sting. Yeah. So Sting, we had gotten a screener copy of. This one comes to theaters, I think, next week. This is April 12th that it's heading to theaters. And I will always watch a giant bug movie. Like, honestly, I'm just going to say it. This might be my year. Like, somebody is listening to me and saying, like, you know, what does Becca want? Nuns? Because I've gotten Nuns and Bugs. And there's another spider film coming to Shudder called Infested.
A French one that I've heard is good too. Yeah, it looks like a different thing. Yeah.
And I'm just like, somebody's like listening to me and finally saying, let's bring back the Nuns and Bugs. If I get a shark movie later on this year, it's clear.
Shark
it's
nun.
Clear that. Yeah, Shark Nun universe is paying attention to the show. They're listening.
So is this a spider? It is obviously a spider shape, but is it a spider movie or is this an alien? Because the opening shot, and this isn't a spoiler really, is that this is an alien version of a spider. Like, the opening is something flying to Earth and a kind of egg opening. So I was like, oh, and I don't know if that made me like it more, but like, I'm less in the bag for this kind of movie normally than you are. And, you know, so you were watching it and then I was just curious afterwards. And I think I just really dug it because
you loved it.
Well, I think what I loved, some of the tonal stuff is at times uneven between, is this a serious family movie about a family or is this a horror comedy? It's a little confused there. I think the horror comedy works less actually at times. I think a couple of the characters maybe take me out when they cameo in, but everything with the bug is
amazing.
Yeah, I get out of these like where you have a higher tolerance and other friends of mine too with like shark movies when they're like just, you know, an asylum kind of shark. I don't
know how you don't.
I struggle with things when I just know it's just a visual effect. And at no point did this not look like a absolutely badass creature feature And it reminds me a bit of the short film of the guy who would go on to make Eight-Legged Freaks, but when he made the short film, it was a lot more, you know, scary, and it gets bigger and bigger. And so it's about a young girl who lives in an apartment, and there's in her dad's or her father figure in her life. It's not her actual dad. He is a comic book illustrator, and she writes things, and she's a little darker, and she finds this little tiny little spider that she starts feeding roaches to, and it gets bigger and bigger and starts taking over this apartment complex as a man-eater, and that's all you need to know. But when it goes gory, it really pushes the envelope. And we were debating, because you were like, this can't be Brooklyn, because
literally while we're watching the film, I text Elric and I was like, there is no way this film was made in the States, because the budget feels big. It feels, I would put it at least like 5 to 7, if not higher. And it's a no-name cast, contained horror, like, and it's a horror comedy, and nobody is bankrolling horror comedies at that budget level right now. They're just really hard to get moving. And so I kept saying, I was like, I know that they're saying this is Brooklyn. There's no way this was made in the States. Well, and then I'll Google.
Well, the opening credits. I was watching the opening credits.
Oh, I didn't even catch that.
And it said Screen Australia.
Oh,
and so once I saw that, it's the director of Wormwood. And
I do love Wormwood. That's a good one.
And then at what was clear, I'm pretty sure there's like probably 5 or 6 shots that were probably shot in New York exteriors, but mostly there's a snowstorm and we're all in the apartment. And there's a couple times where it feels a little sparse because you're in an apartment complex with, you know, only a handful of characters. But overall, I think it just did something by focusing on the family, this family unit in a little bit of crisis, even without the spider being part with a new baby. And so, you know, it just kind of batted above what I thought it was going to do. And that's always a nice way to be surprised. And I found myself enjoying the creature. And maybe it was also knowing that's not just a spider movie, it's an alien spider movie, which makes me a little more excited.
Yeah, because I kept waiting to see what the spider could do next, because it was an alien. I mean, I will watch a spider movie. I mean, honestly, that spider could have been the size of a regular spider and I would have still watched the entire thing. But that said, because it was an alien spider, it had a moment of kind of feeling unhinged because I wasn't sure what it could do. You got the idea that it had ability. I'm going to sneeze. Excuse me. Thank you. Ernie, please keep that in so everyone can feel the glory that is my springtime allergies. But that said, I liked that it was an alien because it felt like there was this, oh shit, anything can happen now, because it does have this like crazy alien ability to it.
And in a way, it's like a kid's movie to an extent, because it's a kid's point of view and the kid protagonist for a lot of it, but it's much darker in terms of the effects and the gore.
And gory, super gory. So that was The Sting. I'm going to go ahead and follow this up with another animal attack movie. Again, the universe has given me gifts. This is actually a TV series that I knew nothing about until somebody sent me a GIF of a lobster attacking somebody and was like, have you seen this?
Oh boy.
And then I was like, I have not seen this. What is this? And it's like a major fucking TV show that ran on the CW last year that I didn't know existed, called The Swarm, from 2023. It literally ran like March last year on CW. And it is based on a book that I had vague notions of, but I had never read, called The Swarm. And it is about all of the ocean animals start attacking humans. It starts with whales in the first episode, and then it goes to lobsters and jellyfish and crabs and hordes, all of the ocean creatures attacking humans and just basically going kind of nuts. So like the very first thing that you get is these people out. It's a great, great scene. These people are out for this sightseeing whale watching thing. And these humpbacks are doing this thing where they take up out of the water and then kind of flop down. And everybody's like, oh my God, it's so beautiful. They're performing for us. And then you see one rise up out of the water and you realize it's going to land directly on top of the boat and capsize it. It just comes smashing down. And then the other whales are doing it too. And then you see pods of orca come in and start trying to eat the people. And it's amazing. And so, yeah, this ran for 8 episodes on CW last year. This was big budget. It's basically about a epidemic where suddenly one day all of the ocean's creatures start attacking humans, and it's on a global scale. So you're following an ensemble cast. You're following people. The whales are all in Vancouver. And then you go over the second episode features the killer lobster, and that one's with a chef in France who's trying to cook lobsters. And then you'll go someplace else and there'll be crabs and someplace else and there's jellyfish. And so it's a global epidemic that's happening. And then it's up to all of these different scientists, specifically one group of scientists in the Arctic who are trying to figure out why this is happening and what's going on. It gets kind of cosmic, which I was shocked by as well. Like it's got this kind of Lovecraftian side of where it goes towards the end of this series run. This was apparently supposed to keep going and it didn't get renewed for a second season. And fuck y'all, I loved this. And I'm really sad now that it didn't get renewed. But yeah, this was surprisingly, it's not gory. Like don't picture like, you know, full Lovecraft, like creatures rising up out of the ocean at the end. And, you know, we're not seeing like whales rip people in two or anything like that. It does feel contained ecological horror in that sense. You're just kind of seeing what they're capable of. But that said, I had a blast with this. I ended up watching all 8 episodes in the course of 3 days. So that is The Swarm, not Swarm, the influencer icon TV show last year that wasn't really horror, but just had a horror font.
And it had a couple horror, like there's murder. And it was an interesting show, actually.
It was an interesting show. I won't pick on it. I watched the first couple episodes and was like, I can see this going. That didn't get renewed for another season either. What up, Hollywood? But The Swarm, and this is currently available for free on CW. I downloaded the CW app on my Roku and I watched all 8 episodes for free. So it's there and it's so worth it. This was fun.
And when you finish you can watch the Michael Caine, The Swarm, with all the killer bees or whatever it was called.
Also great. Yeah. And there was the Netflix movie from last year, the French one, about the woman raising grasshoppers and discovers that they breed more plentifully if she feeds them her own blood.
I never watched it, but I remember reading it.
They become man-eaters. It was good. Okay. It was really good. That was called The Swarm, too.
I do a little Lovecraftian one. Kind of Lovecraftian. The new one coming, it will be coming out today, Friday, from Shudder, called Baghead. And we got a screener of that, and it was interesting because I saw some not so great initial reviews on Letterboxd, and sometimes you don't know what that's coming from. Like if you see a bunch of one stars, you can't really judge it. And it's very well made. The only thing I'd say that it suffers from is that as I'm watching it, I'm watching this going, I bet if this was a short film, it would have been a great short film because it's got such a high concept creature thing. And of course, sure enough, I look it up and yes, this was a short that was then turned into a feature. And sometimes you can feel that with the padding of certain stories. But this one has such a great idea and it is executed well. It's basically you open with Peter Milan, who's a very famous British actor. And he is an older guy running this bar. And he's like, it's going to end with me. He's making a video for whoever is going to own this bar next. He's going to end with me. I'm going down there and I'm going to end this. And he goes downstairs to something that you don't really know what it is. And he's trying to burn this bar down. But of course, he ends up being the one who dies. And then it gets left to his young daughter, who's very estranged. And they have not said two words together in years. And she's quite young, like 20 years old or something. Her and her friend she's kind of grown up in, other alternative housing and stuff as a result of him being a bad parent. She inherits this bar. She's like, okay. And you come to realize that once your name is on the lease of this bar, downstairs of this bar in the basement, there is a creature or a woman who wears a bag over her head. And of course, she doesn't believe this, but some guy comes in and says, I'll give you $2,000 if I can talk to her. I want to see my dead wife again. And she's like, what? $2,000? Sure. Go downstairs. No big deal. Goes downstairs. And then sure enough, there is something there in a bag and it looks very creature-like and Lovecraftian.
Is it his dead wife?
Well, no. So it's a creature that you have 2 minutes of time if it takes an object. So in this case, he gives her a wedding ring and it basically swallows it. And then it brings your dead. So it's basically got a little bit of talk to me, but a more emotional in the sense that you're talking to a loved one. That's why you use it. And for 2 minutes, it's completely your loved one. And after 2 minutes, if you don't time it, this is why I said it's a great short kind of high concept. After 2 minutes, it still looks like your one, but now it's something darker. And it's like taking you down and saying awful things and becoming cruel. And because its only goal is to get out. It wants to be free, but it's kind of in a curse where whoever owns this bar is also the person who has to make sure this thing never escapes. So now she's saddled with this curse, and the only advice her dead father has left her is just don't use it. Whatever you do, don't use it, because if you use it, it will become more powerful and you won't be able to control it. And she has the ability to control it. So it was one of those things that as I was watching, I was like, it's going for a big myth. It's probably going for too much. Like, it's trying to fit in a lot of a big myth into a film. But that said, it's made very well. It looks really good. And it's got a really cool creature. Maybe, you know, sometimes you watch a good creature feature, the rules don't always, like, they strap its arms in, but then after 2 minutes, it just is flying around the room. You're like, well, what are the straps for? It has a few logic issues like that, but I still think it's really solid and entertaining and a good, like, Friday night watch, because it is really, it feels a little more old school. It's British. But I don't want to say more than that, because it becomes very much about why would you have to use it? Who do you need to talk to that kind of forces you to start using the thing that then is going to grow in power? So Baghead coming out right about now from a person who definitely had done a short before of this. I'm not sure if they'd done anything else. Alberto Corridor.
Nice. Okay. I have this one on my list. I'm going to do something crazy here.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about a video game I have been playing.
Okay.
I know, I don't usually talk about video games, but I have become kind of obsessed and addicted with one. And admittedly, there was one night this week where usually I watch a film a night. And there was a night this week where I was like, fuck movies, I'm playing this game all night. And this is the video game Cult of Lamb, okay, which sounds like Cult of Thorn. Yeah. And everybody's going to be like, Friday the 13th. It is not Cult of Thorn, not Friday, Halloween. Yeah. Sorry, brain. So yeah, it is not Cult of Thorn. This is called Cult of Lamb. And the setup of this game is that you are an adorable, cute little lamb. Like, picture the cutest little lamb with big eyes ever. And you are being sacrificed to these Lovecraftian gods. And they look like total Lovecraftian, like multi-eyed, like Cthulhu, Shagoth type gods. And you have been sacrificed, and they take pity on you, and they decide to send you back to Earth as a demon. And your goal is to recruit as many followers as you can for your cult and sacrifice and grow in power and worship them because they spared you. And it is so, you're literally creating a cult, and you're the most adorable lamb ever. And you're praising these Lovecraftian gods. So it is this amazing mix of adorable cuteness, folk horror, and Lovecraft ever. And I literally lost an entire night. I'm not kidding. Like 5 hours playing this, to the point that it was like me in college, where I used to have to force myself to go to bed at like 2 a.m. I would suddenly have this realization of like, fuck, I have class in the morning at 8 a.m. I have to stop playing Silent Hill. That's how this was last Tuesday with Cult of Lamb, where I was suddenly like, fuck, I've got class in the morning at 8 a.m. I have to like put myself to bed. And it was like,
the difference is you're now teaching that class.
I'm now teaching that class, and I still had that same level of obsessive. This is why I had to stop playing video games with such the fervor that I used to. I have problems stopping them. Yeah. It's exactly what I see in my kid with like Roblox. Like I always had problems stopping, especially if it was like a game or something where you were on like an adventure path or there was a goal. I would have problems stopping because it was always like, I've just got to get to that next checkpoint and things like that. Like I could never stop. And that's how this was. So this was, and I mean, I've played games since then. Like I played like, you know, Baby in Yellow and Hello Neighbor and all kind of the fun little horror games. But this is the first one where I blinked and 5 hours had passed and I was like, oh, fuck, I have to go to bed. So Cult of Lamb, I played it on Switch, but this is pretty much available everywhere.
Yeah, it looks really cute. Seeing it on
it's
the
adorable.
Switch, I think my kids would probably dig it.
It does. You do kill people with a big old knife.
Interesting.
You sacrifice them, but it's really fun. It's, like I said, adorably cute, folklore, Lovecraftian horror, all in one beautiful package.
Speaking of all of those things, I saw one that you saw at the very end of last year, so I'm still counting this as this year for my, you know, watching new horror films. But you saw, I think it was the last thing you saw last year, and it was pretty cool. Me and a friend watched it on Friday or Saturday. Lord of Misrule, directed by William Brent Bell, and it's all those things that you just meant. It's folk horror, British folk horror. It's cult-like. It has a Lovecraftian-looking devil creature by the end of it. It's you know, it's got Ralph Ineson from The Witch, the main guy from The Witch. So it's set in this folk town where this female pastor and her family are there, and you know, the church is sparsely attended, but what is popular is this big street fair that her own daughter is going to be part of, and they kind of, everything's very pagan, very Wicker Man-ish, and they go out into a big field and she disappears. And she starts to learn that it's all about, they have a saying, they keep saying, oh, all is as was. And it's very frustrating to her. And everyone who's nice to her in the first half of the movie starts to act super weird and odd. And these older women, you know, get real strange in the middle of this. And it was quite intriguing. It was a little slow at times where you're just like half in it. But then other times it would start to like really gather steam towards like a really kind of cool, interesting dark, messed up ending. And it has just really good details on all the arts and crafts that you expect in a folk world. Mm-hmm. I think it really nailed all of those things. But for somebody, if you're looking for a good British folk horror that's not being discussed much, like I haven't heard much about it, and still
didn't even get much love last Christmas. No. And I kind of loved that it was doing something different, that it was a Christmas folk story I had not heard before.
It's still in the new release, so it's still renting for the like $4 or whatever. So it hasn't, maybe it will pick up steam once it's like free on a Shudder or something. But it has a lot of it production values are pretty big, and by the end it definitely grows to something. But it is interesting to see a movie that can put a new kind of spin on, not just be a redo of Wicker Man, which is tough shoes to fill. I think I thought it was pretty good and pretty interesting, so put that one on. Lord of Misery, I think maybe it's not a great title to, you know what I mean, like it's a title that suits the movie, but you know, when you're sharing a movie, Lord of Misrule.
The Lord of Misrule has been around. I feel like that is the historical name of some type of folklore character, because I only know this, and this is so nerdy, but there is a perfume that comes out that I love at Christmas time. It's like a bath scent at Lush, and it's called Lord of Misrule. And I know they didn't name it after the movie. So I can only assume that there is like a folk character that's been around for a long time called the Lord of Misrule.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it's a dark thing that lives in the forest, and it's interesting because the book I'm reading at the exact same time is, and I mentioned him recently, he's one of my favorite writers this year, Ronald Malfi. I read one of his books earlier this year, and it was like one of my favorites, and now I'm reading one called Bone White, and that's set in a kind of the frozen parts of Alaska. And it's in this town where surrounded by woods, where everyone living in this town believes there's this darkness beyond in the woods with some sort of devil like creature that touches you and there's a mass killing. So I'm halfway through that book. Real good. Real. If people are looking for something on that wavelength, that's my only halfway through pitch, but it's pretty creepy so far. Yeah. It's always fun when you come across a newish, like a more modern writer that you were unaware of, who's like, yeah, so good. Like this is definitely a bestseller type yarn, so look out for that one. Nice. Very good.
Oh, and I just googled, so Lord of Misrule is ridiculously old. We'll go back all the way to ancient Rome. And where it has kind of taken the most, it looks like the biggest name, the Lord of Misrule, was in England and Scotland, where they would appoint a peasant or a sub-deacon to be in charge of the Christmas revelries. They were also often drunkenness and wild partying. So it was like these Bacchanalian celebrations, and the Lord of Misrule was appointed to be in charge of them.
And William Brent Bell did like a very different movie. Like this is very different from the movies. Like he did The Boy and The Boy 2, mm-hmm. and he did the Orphan sequel, which are all fun movies. This is very different. This is very, you know, very much in the pagan realm. And yeah, I thought it was cool. We have one more that we both saw, right?
We do. All right. Remind me. Well, I have books.
Oh, no, we both saw Larry Fessenden's new film Blackout.
Yes. We did both see Blackout. Thank you. I didn't even put that on my list.
Yeah, it was a screener. So, but I believe it's coming out this week, and it's been playing in some theaters and stuff. And Larry's like, if there's a patron saint of independent film for people like us, it's definitely Larry. I mean, especially in his approach to me, what makes him so important just to me personally is that his films are always about grounding something in the real world before you let it become a fantasy film. And he has done.
And it's. Yeah. For me, they're always about a really good character.
Yeah.
And this character exists before the horror comes in and after. Like, that's where I always kind of explain Habit, is like, it is the characters And then vampirism comes into that. But that doesn't have to be there. I would have been fascinated by these characters, even if that vampiric element didn't necessarily come in.
Which feels like a real product of the 90s indie cinema, because he's like making character movies that if the horror element wasn't there, you still would have been interested in an indie drama. Like an indie drama about, you know, a guy and his love life's in New York with, you know, wandering around with his friends talking about art. Like that would have been Habit. And this would have been about an alcoholic and, you know, living in small town America. But he then, because he's a horror, you know, fan, he's always leaning into, and he's kind of been charting. He did Frankenstein recently with Depraved. He, you know, he's done a vampire film. He's done a Wendigo film. He's done a
Wendigo
ecological horror. And so he keeps playing with these different myths. In this case, he's doing a very smart thing, which is, you know, basically linking the title Blackout being with a werewolf story or wolfman story mixed with somebody who's, you know, suffering from alcoholism and kind of blacking out literally. This one seems to be more indie than his others, even, which is hard to imagine given how indie he is.
This is weird. This one felt more, it did. It felt not smaller, but somehow it felt more handmade. Yeah, because it was a lot of improvisation.
Yep, you could definitely tell long takes, improv, things like that.
Improv, like just letting the actors do their thing. It did not feel like you watch something like A Last Winter, which is probably his biggest film, or even Depraved or things like that. And it feels like there is a really set script that they're following. This had moments where the conversation would just kind of drift and then it might come back and then it would drift some more. It just felt very improvisational.
Almost like it's inspired by like what the Addams Family are doing by, you know, the handmade quality of just making movies with people. Cause he's cast. I mean, there's a lot of famous actor cameos that are probably friends of his in this movie. There's a lot of directors who pop up in acting roles, from Joe Swanberg to like
Mark Center,
just tons. And so this one felt the most like almost like a pickup game, not as a negative of the movie, but like, let's get my friends together. I'm going to make another horror film, but I'm going to make it like without asking for permission to make one and getting, you know, which was interesting.
Yeah, it did. It really did feel like that. And it was still very much a Larry Fessenden movie, because it started with a character. We're dealing with a painter who is an alcoholic who keeps having these blackouts. And at the same time, they're having these like crazy attacks in the town. And so you begin to question if he is a werewolf.
He definitely thinks something's wrong. And he's kind of not sure he wants to live anymore. It's kind of leading to a fun, interesting kind of framing device twist in the movie. And it's very much small town America.
Yeah, and it's got this really strong, and this is something that is a big theme for Larry Fessenden. If memory serves, Larry actually wrote a book years ago about how to be eco on film sets. Mm. But a lot of his films have this ecological bend, like The Wendigo, Last Winter, you know, very much have this kind of ecological bend. This one does too, where in the background behind this guy's, well, even in the forefront, as he's kind of battling his own alcoholism and questioning his werewolfism, there is this kind of ecological thing happening with the town.
Corruption and political corruption in the town. Yeah, my negative is because I think it's got a couple parts that are so freaking cool. Like there is a burst of animation in this movie that is so freaking cool that you wish you're like, oh, if that could have happened a couple more times, it'd be even cool. Like it's just so exciting. And then every time the Wolfman itself is on screen and the way it's framed, it's just classic kind of vintage modern indie cinema. My only criticism is like sometimes I think he's putting in too many themes and story. Like there's an immigrant story, there's political corruption, there's a father-son story, there's relationships. So there's a lot.
There's relationships going on.
It's
there
a lot
was
to have
lot.
To contend with on in that a framework was... where you're wanting to just watch this guy on screen a lot. Because he's really good. This guy, Alex Hurt, who I didn't pay attention to his last name until a certain photograph is shown of his father in the narrative of the movie, who's William Hurt. So I was like, oh, this is William Hurt's son is the star of this movie, which I did not, of course, didn't even cross my mind until they showed a photo of his dad in the story. But yeah, I was unfamiliar with this actor, and I thought he was fantastic as the lead.
That was my only complaint as well, because I loved the way that he was treating the werewolf and I loved our main character. But a lot of times when we were going from all of these secondary characters, it felt like we were getting so much information about all of these like five different B plots that were going on at once that it didn't let me just focus on, you know, the one or two storylines that I found really captivating. And it pulled from the main character, which was really good.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was my only complaint about this. But werewolf, you definitely have to watch this for the werewolf
stuff.
This
is still a pure Fessenden pure Fessenden Wolfman type movie. I mean, if I had any other thing, I'd say, well, it would be kind of nice to see Larry play the lead in a movie like this. Like, I know it'd be a totally different
energy. I was wondering why he didn't. It would be a total different like a energy, but he looks like a Wolfman.
It's probably because he wants to focus on the directing. I totally get, especially on an indie, but he would be really interesting.
He never stars in his own films since, I guess, Habit.
Yeah, no, it's been a while. Yeah, it's been a long time. But it's also feels a bit, even though not tonally, but a bit of a piece to that Jim Jarmusch zombie film from a couple years ago that Larry's in, because it almost looks like the same town. And I kept going, is this the same place? Because it looks so similar. Again, this felt like a true indie from Larry. And, you know, again, something to be celebrated. And Marshall Bell's in there. Like, the old time, it was just, I wouldn't have known he was alive, honestly. I was like, hey, Marshall Bell, which was kind of cool. But yeah, no, Larry's always connecting a whole bunch of themes. And I think that's something I want to see even more of in, you know, horror. So big shout out to Larry.
Okay. I was going to shift to books. You got any books that you want to
tackle? Well, I kind of worked my book in. I'm reading this really good book, Bone White.
Bone White. Okay. Two of them I'm going to talk about quickly, and then I'll get to the third one. So yeah, I read three books over the last 3 weeks, because first I had a cold last week, so I was like out. And then I've been doing a consulting gig that requires me to drive cross town to the southern part of LA, which, even though it's 10 miles, that's like 3 hours in LA terms. So I feel like I have done nothing but sit in the car for the last week, which is great because I get to listen to a lot of books on tape. And one of the ones that I listened to was Our Wives Under the Sea. I had heard Bria and Mallory talk about this on Reading Glasses a number of years ago. And finally, I had put it on my list eons ago and then finally got to circle back to it. So this is 2022 by Julia Armfield. And I had wanted to read this because it is aquatic horror, but it is slow burn, very romantic, very sad aquatic horror. I would not go in if you are expecting like Cthulhu to burst up from the depths or sharks to attack people. This is definitely not that story. It is about a woman who is on this deep sea mission. Most of our focus is on her wife, actually. Miri, or Leah, is our main protagonist. And she is waiting for her wife to come back from this deep sea mission that she is on for work. And she comes back from it and she comes back different. She's acting strange. She's taking like frequent baths. She gets nosebleeds. She won't leave the house. And she herself is acting different. It's still her wife and she can still see her wife in there, but it's like something is very slowly taking over her. So it's aquatic horror, but it's not underwater. And again, Cthulhu is not going to burst out at any point and eat humanity or anything like that. This is very slow. It is very sad. It's very romantic. I was not expecting it to go as tragic as it is. It still has a slight cosmic feeling, but it's very much just about this very slow transformation and then kind of what she brought back with her and what is happening. It really felt like cosmic horror, but done by A24. Yeah. So that said, it was
that's my dream movie. That's the movie I want to make.
it was a sad one to listen. I listened to this in the car and I'm like driving along the 5, like crying because of this book. Cool. Like it got tragic. But that was Our Wives Under the Sea from 2022. Next one I read is just releasing this week, probably in just a couple of days of this episode airing. And this is Ghost Station by S.A. Barnes. So I had been a big S.A. Barnes fan because of her book that she put out a couple of years ago called Dead Silence, which was spaceship horror. And I love some spaceship horror. So when I found out she was writing another spaceship horror called Ghost Station, I was like, fuck yeah, I'm in. The concept of this one is a psychologist who specializes in what I'll call space madness. They have a name for it, but it's a type of madness that you can get when you've been in space for a really long time that makes you kill people. Her dad did it. He went on like a crazy killing spree. So she constantly has this PTSD from it. But she ended up becoming a psychologist that specializes in it. And she gets stationed on this, what they think is an abandoned planet with all these other scientists and colonists. And then murders start happening. And she has to try to figure out if somebody is suffering from this space madness as these murders are occurring, or is something else more kind of otherworldly happening on this planet. And they start finding weird stuff on the planet. Like they find stacks of dead aliens and they're like, well, what the fuck happened to the aliens? It's not abandoned. Something killed them all. And then it gets very thingish where nobody trusts anybody because anybody could be going crazy at any given time. Like you could have just killed 20 people and then you show up and you're just like, sup guys. So this was a lot slower pace than her last book. Dead Silence moved like a clip. I still recommend that if you wish Event Horizon was something that you could revisit every day. Dead Silence was epic for that. This moves a lot slower, but it still definitely fed my sci-fi horror love that I don't get a lot of. So it was a lot slower paced, but still really good. This Ghost Station coming from S.A. Barnes, releasing April 9th. And then that brings me to the one that I really loved. The House That Horror Built by Christina Henry. And this one doesn't come out till May, May 14th, but I'm going to go ahead and talk about it because I finished it and loved it. This is from Berkeley Press, which is through Penguin Random House. The concept of this one is that a woman who lives with her son is down on her luck. She's always just kind of worked like fly-by-night jobs, and she's constantly looking for a new gig. She takes a job as a house cleaner for somebody very eccentric. This is in Chicago. And she realizes that the person that she has taken this house cleaning job for, kind of just dusting their stuff, is a famous Hollywood horror director who was defamed a couple of years prior. And so he moved his entire collection, mansion, and life to this isolated mansion in Chicago and doesn't want anybody to know he's there. And his name in the book is Javier Castillo. And he's basically a conceptual cross between Guillermo del Toro and Carpenter, because he's got Carpenter's level of horror film after horror film after horror film, where for like a 2-decade stretch, he made a horror film every 2 years. So you've got a lot of background there. But like character-wise, he is Guillermo del Toro, because he was an avid horror collector. And the house that she is now taking care of is full of horror props from all history of movies, like thousands of props all spread around the house. And it basically sets it up as like a horror museum. And his wife and his son went missing back when he was in Hollywood. And it was this, they just disappeared off the face of the earth. And they, nobody knew if they left him, if they just vanished, if something happened to them, if he killed them, like what happened. And it became this massive scandal, which is why he left LA. And she has now been hired to basically be the housekeeper in his big old creepy Chicago mansion, but nobody knows he's there and she's not allowed to tell anybody. And then while she's doing all this, weird stuff starts happening around the mansion. She starts seeing some of the statues moving. She starts feeling presences. She starts hearing knocking, and you get questioning if the house is haunted or something else is happening. I found this just to be a really clever way into it. It was very self-referential on horror, but that said, it packed an interesting haunted house story inside of that as well. And it really kind of loved on horror films, but at the same time did something really original with it. So this is The House That Horror Built by Christina Henry, coming in May.
All right. So that is that all the books?
That is all my book. I thought that was enough. I read 3 novels in 2 weeks.
You talked about a haunting. You talked about sci-fi and space horror. Our next guest has tackled all of the above.
Let's bring on Vincenzo after this quick break.
All right, welcome back. Coming in live from Toronto, Canada. I guess we've wanted to have on the show and have had on other iterations of the show many years ago. Very pleased to have Vincenzo Natali back in person. How you doing?
Oh, great. It's so nice to see you guys. Thank you.
It's so good to see you and to finally get you on this iteration of the show. I think the last time it was back, like, what was it? Like This Week in Horror?
Or maybe Killer POV. I can't remember. I feel like you might have been on that podcast, but I don't think it would have been in person. So
yeah.
You're just like, these are memories. I cannot.
I'm getting so old. I'm so old now, I don't remember.
You just have to trust us. You're really good. You're funny.
Yeah, you were awesome. It was awesome. We just wanted to get you back in. No, Elric and I have been doing this for, it's coming up on 12 years now. Is that right? Some version of this that we've been doing together. There was like a live version that was like a video show, and then that became a series of podcasts. And so we lose track too.
Yeah.
But it is awesome to get you back on. So yeah, I have always wanted to talk to you because years ago, back when we were kind of first starting those shows, you had this amazing, amazing TV series that came out that I didn't end up seeing until it came to Netflix a couple of years later. But this was 2013. It was
Right.
Darknet. And this is like after the cubes and everything. So like you were very much on the horror map by then. But I have wanted to talk to you since Darknet because that was like it was so good. And it did
Oh.
not get the acclaim here in the States that it deserved. It was so good.
That's so I it touches me because it was such a weird little aberration. It was produced here partly through like a new media fund in Canada.
Oh.
And it was made like basically it was non-union. It was like a student crew that we had. And at that point, I'm trying to think back exactly, but I had sort of gone through the Hollywood, grind for a while and was getting a bit disenchanted. And I had optioned this very obscure but wonderful Japanese TV series called Torihara, which translates as goosebumps. And so we kind of took that as the starting point. And my producing partner, Steve Hoban, who's produced most of my films and you might know from the Ginger Snaps movies and other things, who's really wonderful, pieced this thing together. It's like amazingly weird, complex source, the way he sourced it and financed it for such a small thing. But then it was an anthology horror series, and it had a new media component to it because what we added to the Japanese concept was that it takes place, or it is built around this website on the dark web. Back in the days when the dark web wasn't really a thing, and what was wonderful about the Japanese series was that it was anthology, but within each half hour episode, there were multiple stories. So it wasn't like a half hour story. It was like 3 or 4, 5, 7 minute stories. And I can't remember if this was a feature of the Japanese series or not, but what I really loved about what we were doing is the stories would then entwine in unexpected ways.
That was the amazing part is like you would be seeing one person's story and it drift into somebody else's, but then it all came back. I remember at the time I wrote about it on the Blumhouse website and I remember I compared it to like Trick or Treats, interconnectivity and how kind of the stories are constantly weaving, but this did it so cleverly where like you would think that I remember in one of the, this may have actually been the first episode where we're following this girl who thinks that her neighbor's watching her, and then you're following his story for a little bit, but then at the end you realize that something else is going on and it all interconnects back. But even I remember the rat logo, the rat with the axe was like the
Right.
logo of the website that they were all going to post fucked up shit. And that's what kind of what brought them all together. It was just so cleverly done. So I
Oh,
loved it
thank
so
you.
much.
That's so
I
nice.
needed more of it. I needed more.
We wanted to do more, and it was picked up by Netflix, amazingly enough.
I assume it
And they
did
wanted to
well
do a
there.
second season. I think it did. It was sort of in the early days too of Netflix. I mean, that's how far back this goes. And they were going to do the second season, then they chose not to at some point for some whatever reason. So it
Well,
kind
that's
of drifted
tight.
away. I don't think you can get it anywhere. Maybe on the
Wow.
dark
Okay.
web.
On the dark
That's the
web.
only place you
I'll
could find it.
reconcile, find it. It's lurking
We exist
somewhere.
in the dark web. What I really want to
Yeah.
ask you about is being so old, all of us. I just really want to focus this about us being old because I saw you post a couple of days or yesterday maybe about Cube being as old as, and it shocked me because I
Oh my
have, it's
gosh.
always fun when you're talking to someone, but I was probably, I have, how many years is Cube? Was it
It was
ago?
1999 because I was in college.
Yeah.
I remember it.
Well, I hate to say
Longer?
it was released, it was one of those films that kind of disseminated slowly through the world. So depending on where you were, it could be 1999, but it was actually finished in 1997.
Because I think I saw it closer to that because I saw it at the New Zealand International Film Festival, and Ann Timpson would program some of the genre stuff that would go there, and it would be like, very, it's a very high-end festival that would get tons of movies from around the world. So I would have been, I don't know, 20-ish, and I'm sitting there getting my kind of mind blown by this, just the, I think even on a conceptual level, how those two things can complement each other and rarely do outside of Kubrick or something. It was just one of those early movies that really was a bit of a game changer about what a movie could look and feel like, especially an independent movie, And so it's just funny when you posted a couple of days ago about now it might be time for a restoration. I was like, oh, let's talk about that.
Yeah,
I
I
know it's shocking.
remember.
No, it's
Oh, the very first time I saw it was on, it used to play on Sci-Fi here. In the States, it played Sci-Fi Channel. And at the time, sci-fi, they showed a mix of stuff. Like it was a lot of like, the Crocodile, alligator movies, but there was also they showed kind of traditional horror and more cerebral sci-fi. And I remember finding that at some point in the late 90s and just being completely blown away by it. But like, how did you get to the point of making that? I mean, knowing that it's kind of a small, very much a clever way that you did all of it. How did you get to that point? Like, where was your beginning with the feature?
As is often the case, stupid luck, really, because I don't know that I could have made that film in a traditional way. At that time, people weren't really making one set or one location movies. That wasn't a thing. And in fact, whenever I showed the script to anyone, it was always like, well, this is a short film. This isn't a feature film. But I was very fortunate and I was accepted to kind of the Canadian equivalent of the American Film Institute, called the Canadian Film Center. I went through their program, made a short film, and they had a feature film arm called the Feature Film Project that I applied to with Cube, and lo and behold, they said yes. I mean,
Gotcha.
that's definitely the Coles Notes version, but it was really wonderful because it was actually the best and worst thing that could happen to me, because for my first film, I got to make the movie I wanted to make the way I wanted to make it, total creative control. Albeit it was hard to make it and we didn't have a lot of money, but it was my movie. So the worst part of it was like afterwards getting my second film made because and realizing, oh, that's not how it works and normally.
And once you do something well, everyone wants you to just repeat that. Repeat. What was the most what did you find in the throes of making that film that you were least prepared for? Because what's interesting about it is it has a lot of different types of actors you have to work with. So that's one thing that a young director having to work with different personalities, the set designs are obviously very specific. Like what was the thing where you're like, oh shit, I'm doing this? I'm always curious about those.
Well, I mean, it was when I walked on the set was because even though it was this very small film, the set itself was rather imposing. It was raised 4 feet off the ground. It stood 14 feet above that. It was lit from behind by literally hundreds of lights. So it was kind of I remember a moment of looking and going, oh, Jesus, what have we wrought? What have we done? Which of course was wonderful, and I made it with my friends. It was written with my lifelong friend Andrei Bajalik and a friend that I made at the Film Center, Graham Manson, and it had David Hewlett, who's my muse, who's been an actor in virtually all of my films since I was 15 years old, and Andrew Miller, and another actor friend and writer collaborator. So it was just this really lovely environment. It was made with rubber bands and paper clips. And it almost killed me. I mean, it really did. It was an incredibly difficult film to make as well, which you wouldn't expect. But I don't recommend shooting in a cube or in a box. Not a
I
great
was gonna
place to be.
so that was actually gonna be one of my follow-up questions is it's this kind of unspoken law that bathrooms are the damn near hardest thing to shoot because you're in this tiny composed space, and no matter where you go, you're gonna catch clips of the crew, your gear, reflections of yourself. And anytime you're in a tiny space, it's hard to light because you're constantly seeing reflections of your light and the audio sucks. Did you have that in the cube? Was it like a thing where you're constantly picking up your gear and people? And yeah, how did you fit a crew inside that? Because you
Well,
never think about it when you're watching it.
I will tell you this. So we are restoring it. It's going through a restoration process. And I was in the color grading suite yesterday and we're watching a scene. I was like, wait, hold on just a sec. Pause there. There's a coffee cup in the fucking cube.
Makes it way more livable.
I'd never.
It's been there for 20 some years.
Now it may be because, when you shoot 35 millimeter, you're For your theatrical version, you're always extracting from a larger frame. So it is because it was on the edge of the frame, it's possible in all theatrical versions and video versions that that was cropped out. It's possible. But I have never seen it, nor has anyone ever brought it up. But somebody, probably me, left their coffee cup in the cube, which I, as you can imagine, erased immediately.
But I mean, such a long shot. I know you can't, when you're in these things, you can never expect what they're, but the influence, I think it's influenced things that even might not claim it as influence, whether from anything like a Saw movie, but to like, I was thinking about it recently, even just the play on words cube or cubicle, being the Ben Stiller TV show on Apple recently.
Right.
That's just an incredible show. But it's like, when you really think about it, it's kind of cube because they are in this alternate set. And so I think even people who don't realize the influence, I think it has kind of seeped its way into a lot of different kind of cultural moments.
And it's still one that I teach to a lot, because that is like the golden goose with my students, is how do we find the film that is one location and like five actors and make that the feature. Like, it is a golden goose because it's something that becomes accessible for students to do when they first emerge, assuming that Marvel's not there to hand them their first $120 million contract straight out of grad school. What can they do? And I'm always like, you make it yourself. Because Elric and I both did that. We both made our features ourselves because nobody was there. And so my students are always trying to figure out, like, what is the $150,000 film I can shoot? One set, five actors. And this is one that I always point to. And I'm like, that's the way to do it. That does something high concept, low production.
Yeah. I mean, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And I always felt like we kind of stumbled on something that already existed in a way. That it was the writing of it. I don't know if you've had this experience, but it was almost more like archaeology than writing. Like, we were finding something rather than building it. And I feel lucky. I actually feel lucky. It's just like we stumbled on this very special thing. And it haunts me to this day. It's like,
no, that's if you make
my tombstone will be a cube shaped stone. I know it. Like, that's
what were your, what it's gonna be. Because I actually don't know the answer to this. It's always more fun to, like, I know you have a broad taste in film, but like, what were your obsessions heading into film school? What, like, because you've kind of probably largely because of Cube, but I'm curious if it's also because of your interest, fallen into almost a science fiction genre, horror genre hybrid through most of your work, definitely with the science fiction angle to a lot of stuff. So I even just watched Tall Grass this weekend, and the Kubrickian shooting style of it really kept, you know, I noticed that, and the maze like quality to things. So I'm just curious, like, what was the, when you're coming up wanting to make films before leading into Cube, was sci-fi one of the big drives, or is it broader than that?
Yeah, no, I haven't matured since I was.
No, none of us do.
Whatever, 12 years old. I have no interest in doing anything other than science fiction, horror, and fantasy.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that is, but I'm lucky. You know, I really got to do what I wanted. It's hard. You know what it's like. It's slow, brutal. The thing is, I think I've always wanted to do something different. Mm. That's, you know, the thing. Like, when you go to studios always look back, mm-hmm. and filmmakers always look forward. Mm-hmm. And so it's the struggle for me has always been, well, how do I get people to look forward? Because I don't want to repeat stuff. And very often when things are made available to me, which is not that often, but when they are, it's usually like, oh, they're fine, but it's not anything new. And I think that's why Cube was kind of the best and worst things to happen, because it did feel like that. And then it was like, after that, I was like, I can't go back. I have to keep trying to do that. Like, it would feel like less of an experience if I didn't. And that proved to be quite, you know, quite challenging.
How conscious were you of that second film? Like, what to make something radically different? Was that a conscious choice, or?
And I wanted to have as much control as well. Cause like with Cube, you know, you're the one who's kind of the artist behind everything. A lot of times on other films, once you get a little bit bigger, you lose that control.
I wasn't successful enough to lose control. Like, I never got the budgets that got to the level where people were trying to pry control away from me. So I was, in a way, that was good. I wanted my second film to be Splice. Like, when I finished Cube, when Cube was out in the world, I had the Splice script, but it was just, and there was like a few close starts on that one, but it was just, I think, too expensive, a little too scary. So that ended up happening, you know, about a decade later. But
which is funny, because I think Splice is my favorite of your films still. I just really like Splice. And I think it's when we met, actually, was over Splice. But I think if that had been made a little earlier in the late 80s, there probably would be three or four Splice movies. You know what I mean? Because it just has the DNA of saying that they would have, like a Scanners, that you can almost see the other movies being, and I think it would have hit, but because sometimes timing is, some things just don't fall in the right moment, you know?
I kept
Oh,
waiting
that's
for someone
fun.
else to do it.
Yeah.
Oh,
No,
thank
I
you
get it.
guys.
Yeah.
That's my baby, you know. I love
Yeah, I love
the
Slice, yeah.
I have such affection for that.
Ren, yeah.
And also because I really didn't think it was going to happen. Like I there was a moment in like 1999-ish where I was in prep on that film. Like it was being prepped. I was putting it together with a serious producer, spending a lot of money designing stuff, storyboarding everything. And then the producer chose not to do it. And I was like, well, now I'm really screwed because now there's $500,000 against this movie that we've spent that if anyone wanting to pick it up is going to have to, you know, pay this other guy off. So I just thought, well, that's it. And I just kept waiting to read about the genetic Frankenstein movie. And then for some reason it never happened. I was like, what's going on? And then I got lucky, you know, a couple of things sort of fell into place, and then it gathered steam again. But yeah, it's funny you should say that because I feel like, oh, it's such an obvious thing to do, and you wonder why these things happen when they do, and how. I mean, sure, you've had experiences yourselves where you have an idea, you're working on something, and then someone else makes a movie like that. You know, like
Constantly.
I totally believe in collective consciousness and that
That's
this
what I
stuff is out in the
always,
ether.
yeah, my students have asked about it before, and I'm always like that for me, it's something the idea of like people all kind of will experience the same things together, and then something will happen to put it back into conversation. I actually wrote an article for Fangoria about this last week about why within the last 2 years we've had five major nun films. Like, was there a kickoff? And I'm like, maybe the Nun too, or the Nun in general. But that said, the nun films that are coming are not anything like that. So what was it that kind of put those back into the collective radar? And who knows? But yeah, it happens.
I mean, it's. It...
It's fast, like, oh, sorry.
Oh,
Oh, please.
no, you keep.
No, I was gonna say with Tall Grass, it was a similar thing in that when I wrote that script 5 years before I made the movie, and of course it's based on the Joe Hill Stephen King story, which was written a number of years before that. But by the time I made it, all of a sudden there were all these folk horror films coming out.
Yeah.
And it just, yeah, I find it, I really think it's interesting. It's not this, it happens too often to be coincidence. It has to be something about how, I don't know, culture circulates ideas, and yeah, it happens constantly. I'm a constant. I keep writing things, and then someone else releases it.
Your
I'm like,
but what I always figure
volcano
is
Dante's Peak problem.
if they
Yeah.
are releasing it as I'm writing it, I always think, well, I'm at least 3 years out from when this gets released, and that what I would actually end up creating or what would actually end up getting released is not going to look anything like what is out. Because it's always like, you know, by that time it would have shifted ideas repeatedly. So,
And and also you don't know when, like for instance, I saw Tall Grass this weekend, totally missed that you had made it. I saw it being released to Netflix all the, a couple years ago, looked interesting to me, didn't know much about it, but like I didn't, it just didn't watch it. And so now this was my perfect moment. Like, oh, great. So here I am watching it after that moment, where there's no longer, and even though it is folk horror, it still feels to me like science fiction.
it, me too.
And that's what I think that's something I like about your style, that I think you're always finding the sci-fi, even if it's a horror movie, it feels like the science fiction version of that horror movie, which is interesting. It's a grounded emotional movie that it's not saying it's cold like a lot of science fiction, because it's
No.
definitely your family movie in some ways. But I think the shooting style and just maybe your worldview comes across in somehow in some of the ways, even where you place camera above things a lot of times is it very it was just very interesting. But I think the important thing to take away from this idea that there's a if there's a collective unconscious with ideas is that's why you can't be general, because people have to be even more specific and more individual to themselves, because like Larry Fessenden's doing a Wolfman movie same year as Blumhouse is doing, well, but no one can do a Wolfman movie the way someone like Larry Fessenden's going to choose to do it, right? Like it doesn't matter, there could be 10 movies being made, and he and that's I think the thing about voice, right? We have to we can't just try to be like the Hollywood model, because that's a surefire way to fail, I think, with these kind of things. But you know, and you've done that, so congratulations, you're here to get your award.
Well, I don't know if I succeeded, but yes, I really believe in that. Of course, it's voice, and you know, one of my favorite film school exercise was, which we actually did when I was at the Canadian Film Center, was a direct seven directors got the same, not only the same script, they got the same crew and cast.
Oh,
And
nice.
they went without, and the rule was, of course, you couldn't know what the other person was going to do. And you got seven different films.
Completely. Yeah. I've loved doing that exercise.
Yeah, no, things like
Yeah.
that,
So
it's for your mind, right?
yeah. Exactly.
So, I wanted to ask kind of, going forward with TV and everything, like, which do you have a preference between TV or film? Kind of where does your predilection lie?
Oh, film.
Film by
Can
far.
I rephrase it? Do you
Yes.
like getting earning a li making a living, or do you like movies?
Well, no, because I mean, you've done so many what I'm going to call like artist-driven TV shows, like Hannibal. Like you did a
Hannibal's
lot of
one of the best
Hannibal
shows to
and
ever exist, and the work on that is so beautiful. It feels like a
yeah.
movie every episode.
And like Wayward Pines, American Gods, these are ones that I look at and I see it more as like an artist-driven show, not like a replicate everything that the showrunner tells you. Or you did Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of
That is
Curiosities.
movies, really. They're all
That is,
movies.
those
Yeah.
are like mini
They're movies,
movies.
yeah.
So what was that one like? Like where did you guys shoot and how did you get to pick the stories for that? Or were they kind of already given to you?
With Cabinet, long ago, I was going to do a werewolf movie that Guillermo was gonna, he actually brought me a script to direct. And then sometime after, he said, "Let's go have lunch." So I went and had lunch, and he said, "I'm giving someone else the werewolf movie, but I'm going to give you one of these episodes of this thing." So I wrote. Well, at first, I wanted to get there's a if you know this wonderful Japanese horror manga artist Junji Ito,
Oh, yeah.
I
Oh, yes.
wanted to get one of the craziest stories I've ever read
Oh, which
that he did
one?
called Hanging Balloons.
Is that where the people's heads start floating? Okay, yeah. That's I've
It's
read
incredible.
every Junji Ito book. I even wrote the read the one he wrote about his cat. Which is not it's not a horror exactly. It's just he loves his cat. But yeah, it's still fun. But yeah, that's a
But
good
you couldn't
one.
get the rights, or it's too crazy for them.
No. I think they genuinely tried to get them and it wasn't possible for whatever reason. So Guillermo had a selection of stories. And at that point, I was like, okay, let me. It's not that I didn't want to do the ones that were on his list, but I was just keen to do a crazy Junji Ito story. So then
Which I
I
can
really
really see
sat
your
down and.
style doing that. I don't think you should
Oh,
give up on
yeah.
that. I think I can see your style suiting that so well, you know.
The one
Oh,
that
he's such a.
I've always been obsessed with is the one where people are shoving themselves into the cave walls and then they can't get back out. Like they stick themselves into like cracks in caves so far they can't get back out. And it's like an epidemic of everybody doing it and they don't know why. They just suddenly wake up and feel compelled to shove themselves into these rock crevices. It's so fucked up. It's wonderful.
So completely original. I mean,
Yeah.
just it's, or if you've ever read this graphic novel he wrote called Remina, I think. I hope I'm that's
Remina? Yeah, something like that.
Remina.
Yeah.
Anyway, amazing. But so because that wasn't possible, Guillermo did have a menu of stories that he had optioned. And when I came across Graveyard Rats, I was like, well, I really know how to do this. This is very me in some way. So I chose, and also, I've done a number of short films. I've made short films since I was a kid, and I'm sure you guys have made short films too. It's a very particular thing to find a story that works in that format. And the Graveyard Rats story really works for something like that. So I wrote that, and then a number of years went by, and I was like, I guess that's not happening. And then out of the blue, at the moment, of course, when I was incredibly busy, they were like, we're going. So I barely made it onto their schedule. I was finishing something else, so I was the last up. But it was wonderful, and they shot it in Toronto, my hometown. They let me cast David Hewlett, my muse, who's been in a couple of Guillermo's movies.
Oh, I didn't realize I didn't catch David in his films. What's he been?
He was in Shape of Water and he was
Ah.
in Nightmare Alley.
I probably did
Oh,
at the
wow.
time and then
He's like
didn't.
the he's the you wouldn't recognize it. No, but he's like
Ah.
unrecognizable. He looks so weird. In Shape of Water, he's like the mustachioed scientist.
Okay.
And Shape of Water, his very small part, but he's like running the lie detector.
So for people listening who aren't aware, they all know that I think one of the greatest Canadian films of all time is Pin. P-I-N, and the star of that movie was obviously the star of Cube, but he was also a childhood friend of yours, I believe.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah, David was the first real actor I ever worked with. Like in high school, I asked him. When I stopped acting in my own movies, it was David who that's took so over. Cool.
I did not even make the connection that the guy from Cube was the kid from Pin, and my mind just exploded, y'all.
I don't think I really knew, because he has a lot of hair back in in Pin, and he's just got a different kind of shape to him almost when he was young. He's such a wonderful actor. Whenever he pops up in your stuff, I'm always happy about that too. Was Cronenberg and like I know this sounds like a dumb generic question to somebody from Canada, but he was obviously in the sci-fi horror realm, and you're growing up in Toronto. How was he on your radar when you were young, or was that not somebody you discovered till you're a little older?
Oh no, he was on radar when I was young. Yeah, I mean, to me, the unholy trinity was always Cronenberg, Kubrick, and Lynch.
Yeah,
those were
kind of still my holy trinity.
Yeah, that's
still probably my three favorites.
I think. At a point where I sort of felt like I'd matured, those are probably that was my three North Stars. If that makes sense. But yes, Cronenberg. I mean, I'm of a certain vintage. So 1980, maybe I was 11, and that's when Scanners came out.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe it was 81 actually. And in any case, that was peak time for me. That was the first Cronenberg film. I think maybe I'd heard of The Brood, but anyway, that was the one I was aware of. And from that moment onward,
I'm representing, by the way,
fascinated by him.
I'm
Oh, look at that.
I'm representing the Cronenberg, nice shirt. The Cronenberg love.
I love The Brood.
I think it's his best. I think like now that I'm older, I realize that might be his best, most mature and personal movie, even though I love that, there's so many movies, so many different.
I'll call it most mature. Yeah. I can't say it's my fave, but
something about
it's by far the most mature.
And it's different. Again, like all the great filmmakers, like it depends which one you haven't seen for a while. And then, like, I hadn't seen Dead Zone for a while, and I showed it to a class, and I was just floored by how well made it was. His ability to work in studio with studios. It's like his best work, and it's so surprising because he's this like very outsider voice, but when he worked on The Fly and he worked on this, it's like somehow they're totally working in harmony, which you wouldn't expect with the studio. So
no, it's amazing. And those films hold up too. That's the other thing. I think they're so intelligent and thoughtful and well constructed. I like him because he shoots the fantastic in this very academic way. There's no gloss on it. It's very simple, actually. Not simple and it's simplistic, but very classical.
Yeah.
And yet the subject matter is so outrageous. So it's the combination of those two things, which I think also makes them last. They don't, those films, they stand the test of time. And the other thing I must say, especially with The Brood and also with maybe Shivers, for me, they remind me of my childhood. Like that's what my school looked like. That's the building, although it's in Montreal, the location was in Montreal. The building in Shivers looked like the apartment building I grew up in Toronto. Exactly. Like the carpet, the whole thing. Like it. So there's some kind of, I have to admit, like some very personal, it resonates me with me on a very personal level.
It's often the wallpaper, which sounds like a silly thing to say, but if you watch The Brood, the wallpaper in that is almost exactly like wallpaper I would have been seeing in New Zealand growing up, because every house had very specific wallpaper. Yeah, but moving here now, I never see wallpaper anywhere.
I think it fell out of vogue somewhere in the mid 80s. We got really floral in the 80s, and then people stopped putting up wallpaper, thank God, because that shit was a bitch to take down when you wanted to redo your house. So,
I kind of missed the pattern.
Ended the wallpaper. Well, I mean, Wes Anderson does wallpaper. Sure. I mean, like that's his thing, but it's always like a throwback to the 70s. Yeah. Like it has this retro 60s, 70s feel to it. That's a great discussion about wallpapers and
cinema. Hey, I feel like the people want to know.
I wanted to ask you before we move on past In Tall Grass, because I'd seen that movie, actually talked about it on the show when I saw it. I think that was like a pandemic one I watched. But I wanted to ask, because as I was researching today, it said that a lot of your stuff in Tall Grass, you used art designs by Shintaro Kago. And who I know from a couple of, his art and a few of his graphic comics that he has done. But then suddenly seeing how you had used him on In Tall Grass, I wanted to ask kind of like in what capacity and what did he design on the film? Because that's such, when I'm thinking folk art, he's admittedly the last person I would think of when I'm thinking of folk art, like human furniture, giant holes in cranium. Like he's way there. Like it's all this like Itogura type stuff, like this Japanese kind of grotesqueness. But folk art, not like the first person I would head to, but I wanted to find out how you used him on the film because suddenly it like made sense at the same time.
Well, I think, I have to go back to remember this, but I think if you've ever read the Stephen King Joe Hill story, it's very disturbing, and it goes into it's real body horror, really. I mean, and it goes into reproduction and the nature of what we are, what our bodies are, and we're all grass is basically the premise. And so I think that's partly what it brought to mind. And then I think concurrently, I had come across his work, and it was just so shocking to me and so surrealistic and outrageous. And I just sort of thought there was something there. And then my wife, who's Japanese and is fairly well connected in Tokyo, managed to connect with him. So I went to Tokyo and I met with him, and I just said, please, here's the script. Actually, maybe I didn't give him the script. Maybe I just said what it was. And I just said, have fun. Like, give me 20 drawings. And he did 20 amazing drawings. And I was really only able to use one in the film because that's all I could afford. But I had a whole Shintaro Kago sequence designed. And actually, if you, I have a website you can go onto that has storyboards archived on it, and you could see that sequence as it was storyboarded. But it would have cost me $500,000 that I didn't have,
Oh my
unfortunately.
gosh.
And actually, all his art is there too. You can see it. It's beautiful.
That brings
I love no, such a beautiful artist, so
But
gorgeous.
it brings up a key follow-up question, Becca, if you want your mind blown. Who was the storyboard artist on Ginger Snaps?
I was.
Oh, see, that I
I
knew
didn't know
because
you're a storyboard artist at all. I was like,
that was something else I learned today looking through. I was like, you have so many storyboard artist
I
credits.
had no clue, but it makes a lot of sense with the precision of your directing. That in my brain now makes a lot of sense. But talk a little bit about the art side, because I know we are going to talk about graphic novels, but obviously, a clear connection.
Yeah, sure. Well, I was really lucky because I went to film school for a while at a place called Ryerson here in Toronto. And I went for a year and a half and then I quit. And just thinking, like, I don't need film school. And I became a very bad waiter and found it was like, oh, this is like not like doing Super 8 movies anymore. This is really expensive. But I lucked into a job drawing Saturday morning cartoon storyboards at a company here called Nelvana. And it was great because I would work half the year doing boards on Saturday morning kids shows, and then I would get laid off and I'd spend the other half of the year with the money I earned making a little movie. And that continued for about 4 or 5 years. It was really, really great. And it was like film school because when you're doing an animated film, as a storyboard artist, they just give you the script and basically say, draw it. But you're working under the auspices of a director who, then critiques it and changes things. And I really learned a lot and just about filmmaking, even though it was animation. And then I continued doing it. I would sort of did commercials and some small movies. But then when I, oh, sorry.
I was going to say, we can't not mention that you did one of the greatest Saturday morning cartoons for people of my generation, which is the Beetlejuice cartoon. Like that was huge when I was a kid. And the Tales from the Crypt cartoon. And did I see Eek the Cat on there as well? These are like,
It was so much fun.
these are like my childhood show. These are fantastic, fantastic stuff.
I was super lucky. It was really, really nice. It was hard work too, by the way. Nearly killed me. But yeah, so then After Nelvana, I did my sort of swan song as a storyboard artist was for Ginger Snaps because it was my friends who were making that film. It was Steve, my producing partner, who produced it, John Fawcett, who was a friend who directed it, and Karen Walton, who wrote it, actually co-wrote my short film at the Film Center. And they were developing the script for Ginger Snaps while I was there. So yeah, that was my swan
So
song.
that's as close as you got to your werewolf movie after
That's
Guillermo
as
went
close
away.
as
All
ever happened.
right. But I mean that,
I
but that
kind of
is
took it away.
now do I so I the follow-up though, I guess, is do you completely storyboard your own films prior everything, or how specific are you with your storyboards? I know the answer in my brain, but I'm asking you the quiz.
Everything. Even when I do a TV show, it's to the point of it being stupid. Like, even on a TV show, I storyboard every scene. Like, even if people are just sitting at a table talking, I can't. It's like my security blanket. I have to draw it.
How
Not very
simple do
well.
you? Oh, okay,
The
you keep it
drawings aren't
simple.
very
Okay,
good.
yeah. No, I was
Yeah, I was
wondering.
gonna
Yeah.
say, like, are these like stick figures, like my storyboards, where it's like, I think that might be a hand, I don't know, or do you get like detailed with it, like, because you are talented as an artist?
No, I believe storyboards should be designed to be thrown away. They should be disposable. If they're too nice, then they're really, then you fall, you're in danger of falling in love with the drawing. And you miss the opportunity that you are presented with when you're shooting. So the storyboards can be tricky. Like, I think, you have to know how to use them. But it's becoming an indispensable tool for me. Like, it's just how I do it.
Fantastic. Okay, so now that we've gone to the art, let's talk about the kind of swap over into doing a comic last year. You did tech. Where did the idea come from, and what made you say, let's do this as a graphic novel instead of as a film? And kind of how did you make that transition?
Well, I really wanted to do it as a movie, but I thought if I write this script, nobody's going to like this thing. It's going to be expensive. It's not based on anything. I'd sort of been around enough, and it also, I confess, comes out of my frustration with not getting to make Neuromancer, which is I spent years developing as a
Gibson,
feature
yeah,
film,
William Gibson.
the famous William Gibson book, and so this was kind of my way of working that out of my system. And what happened really was it was the yes realization I'm not gonna make this thing. Plus, at the same time, the iPad Pro came out, and that, which I'm using right now to speak to you, that device permitted me to draw on the screen. It was the first pad tablet you could draw on the screen. And then I was like, I think I'd always wanted to do a comic book. I was like, I think I can do this because it's going to make it so much faster, and I can do everything on it. I can pencil it, I can ink it, I can paint it, I can do all the word balloons, all that stuff. And so I did over over a 5-year period.
I
So
was
when
going
I
to
wasn't,
say they're time consuming, which I didn't. I have a comic book coming this year from Dark Horse, and we've been on that for like 2 years. That we it took like maybe 2 months for me to write it, but then the art has been just, it takes a long time. You never realize how much goes into all of it. So yeah, 5 years to do the art for tech.
Yes, but again,
That's
it
wow.
was only in my off time. So when I wasn't working on a movie or a TV
Oh,
show,
yeah.
I would do that. And it was incredibly gratifying because I could do it without getting anyone's permission. I just did it on my own, and then every day, at the end of the day, I would have something. It would be finished. And whereas when you're making a movie, there's always a dog and pony show, and it always takes just an ungodly amount of time, and there's always this sort of Damocles hanging over your head that it's probably never going to happen. So it was a real, I don't know if it's a good or not, but it was a really great experience. And then it's not small. It's like 200 pages, and I was very lucky to get this wonderful publisher, Encyclopocalypse, to put it out, and there it is.
Fantastic.
But
So,
it's
can we have another graphic novel? Or are you thinking of doing another one?
partly, I did it partly because one day I will be put out to pasture as a filmmaker. And so this will be the thing that I can do on my own. in my decrepitude.
But we're all grass, so don't worry about being put out.
We're all grass.
We're going to return to grass. It's going to be
fine.
But I will say, you're somebody who love. I mean, it's one thing when somebody's like, I couldn't get my script made, so I made a graphic novel. You love graphic novels. You love that art form. You sent me a really like a book that I can't even really call a graphic novel because it kind of transcends. It's kind of like almost historic art. And
what book?
What is the name of it? It's sitting over there. I just can't
read. Here.
Yeah, here. And it's not something that it would be on your, like when people think of black hole and graphic novels.
Okay.
This is much
I need more than that to Google because I want to see this now. Here, but if I just Google here, you know, nothing pops up. Who wrote it?
I can grab it. I'll grab it in a second because it's just.
Richard McGuire.
Thank you. Okay. I want to see this.
It's like it almost feels historic and future and existential and all these threads, but it's very minimalist too. Like it's getting smaller and bigger at the same time as it goes, if that makes sense. But it was a really cool, it was something I would have never heard of. And it made me realize, oh, you obviously are, you know, this is a medium you actually seem to care for.
Oh, I love. Yeah. I mean, I wanted to be a comic book artist. Like that was my first love. And then movies, unfortunately, eclipsed that. But I still hold it very dear. And I actually, these days, I find them a little more interesting, you know? I mean, there's so much great new stuff. And then there's so much great old stuff that was never published here. Like a lot of French and Japanese work, like the Junji Ito stuff is, most of that, I don't think is new. I think it's quite old, but was never available to us in English.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's just such a plethora. I can't keep up with it. Like there's so much amazing stuff out there.
I just, that is where, and our listeners know, I usually cover a couple of graphic novels each show. The last show I didn't because I was on novels, but yeah, that is honestly my favorite thing to read. Like I can sit down and read a novel and it's cool and you know, you hallucinate in your head a lot, but I find such joy in reading graphic novels that it is unparalleled by any other thing I can read. Like if it's in graphic novel form, because it just gives me so much more to chew on. And it's not that I'm not still visualizing it to a degree. It just functions differently from novels, but I find them to be so much more enjoyable for me than novels ever could be.
It's very beautiful. And it is, I mean, most comic people will resist saying this, but it is very similar to cinema because it is visual narrative storytelling for the most part. Like Alan Moore would be kicking my ass right now for saying that, but it is true. And so I find them, you know, much more closely related than the novel.
Yeah, I think a lot of filmmakers have come from the graphic, like surprising ones like Alain René, you know, highbrow French director who made Last Year at Marion Bad. And I remember reading a book on him once and he was just obsessed by American comics, obsessed when he was young. And that's what made him want to make movies. And I was like, oh, that's fascinating. You know,
and that
he wanted to do a film. Stan Lee wrote a script for
Alain
René to direct.
Oh,
wow.
And it was called The Ambulance, the Larry Cohen film. That would have been great, though.
That would have been amazing.
Alain René and Larry Cohen. Who would have thought?
Oh, my God. What a combo.
No, when I was doing the comic last year, that was one of the things that I realized is it's not like writing a fiction piece where I have to describe how somebody is standing. Like it's still, and you can show the perspective from which you want people to see the scene. And that for me is crucial because I can show whether I want two people in the frame or one people, or do I want to see somebody side-eyeing somebody else, or do I want it from a high angle or a low angle? Like that for me still lets me control so much of the tone that I want it to have without having to infuse that into a page of descriptors about what the atmosphere feels like. Like I can still do it, execute it quickly by just say, let's do a high angle and they look powerless and things like that. It moves much more to kind of my visual stylings. So I love it. It's still my favorite.
And one artist that you brought up who I probably knew best from a run on Swamp Thing. That was one of the best things I've ever read. But Bernie Wrightson you mentioned. So what was it about Bernie Wrightson's work that, you know, obviously fuels the imagination for sure.
Sure. Well, I just felt that we should, if we're going to talk about a horror comic book artist, then we should talk about Bernie Wrightson. And I know he's extremely well known and so on, but maybe not spoken of as much as he should be, because I think he's kind of a deeply influential creator, and not just in the realm of comic books, but also movies. And in other mediums. And then he was just such a consummate illustrator. He's what he did was so beautiful and elegant, and the world is richer for having him a part of it. So that's why I wanted to bring him up.
What of his work first got in your writer? Because like my age, Creepshow probably was the first thing for some people. Cycle of the Werewolf, for a lot of people, that work he did with King is obviously like a landmark kind of mixed medium piece. What was it for you?
It was Swamp Thing.
Oh yeah.
So when I was quite young, I think they reissued Swamp Thing. I'm not that old enough to know the original run of Swamp Thing, but they reissued the Bernie Wrights and stuff, and it just, you know, I just became obsessed with it. And then later, there was a series of reprintings of his work. When I know it's like 13, they put out, I can't even remember what it's called, but it has a number of things that he did with Bruce Jones, who is a comic book writer, including Jennifer, which is one of the most disturbing things I'd ever read, and a number of his Poe and Lovecraft adaptations. And then, of course, Creepshow sealed the deal. And I just feel like he's, you know, like a lot of filmmakers, he's kind of woven into my DNA, the way he tells stories, and specifically, you know, within the horror space.
Did you ever see his Shining? It was like a TV guide cover, but the original art, you can see it online. It's just this beautiful painting, but of the 97 adaptation of The Shining. So he's not really doing Mick Garris's The Shining, but he's holding the mallet and he's in the snow. It's at night and you can see the hotel in the background. And it's one of my favorite pieces of just anyone, art of any kind. Look it up after this, just write Shining Bernie Wrights, and it's phenomenal, like so cool.
Oh, I'm looking it up right away. Yeah. I've not heard.
Yeah,
of
it's really That's neat. Amazing. But it was for the TV Guide of all things, so like, you know, it's just the most weird thing to find Bernie Wrights.
That is weird.
And I've never read the original Jennifer comic. I knew that the Dario Argento one for Masters of Horror was based on the comic, but I'd never read it. How does the comic compare to the Argento version?
I did see the Masters of Horror one, and which I think I liked, and I seem to recall it was a fairly literal interpretation of it, but it's been so long, I'm not sure of that.
Okay, I just jotted it down. I got to go back and find the original disturbing comic. Yeah,
and beautiful. I'm going to just show you something because I got this the other day, but let's see if I can dig it up.
That's okay. We have, so for this moment, people should be going to YouTube to watch this part, because this will be the visual moment of this podcast.
Yeah.
This is his like 6-page comic book called Muck Monster, and it's the artist edition.
It's huge.
It's so beautiful. I'll just pull out like one of the, you know, a random page. But let me start with this. But
Wow! Yeah. Oh my god!
That's beautiful. But,
and signed by Bernie Wrightson.
Oh, cool!
God, I did not even know. How do you make a comic with that level of art? Because that stuff, I mean, just talking about how it takes years to make these comic books, I cannot even imagine how long it takes him to do these drawings. Like when you're seeing like the hordes of zombies in some of his stuff, and everything is so detailed and the cross hatching, like I'm just blown away by how long that must have taken him to do.
To bring it back around a little bit though, that art looks a little bit like your Cabinet of Curiosity episode. You know, like the period and some of the texture and stuff. So it's interesting. Mm-hmm. I think maybe it was coming through in that piece of yours as well.
I was totally self-conscious. No, I was like, okay, if I'm doing Graveyard Rats, I'm doing Bernie Wrights.
Oh, okay.
This is my Bernie Wrights in tribute. So yes.
And it feels like a creepy, it totally feels like a creepy story too, from that book. So that makes sense.
We like the podcast to be a form of some creative therapy where we loop all your work back together and your influences.
Psychologically through all of it, because we're all grass. Because I know we got to wrap up soon. We had you make a list of some of the weird, newer stuff you've been seeing. We'd love to hear what you've been watching recently. Mostly for us to take notes.
I'll zip through these, but there was just like a few, you know, it's all thanks to Tubi.
Oh, yeah.
Things I've never even heard of.
Our Patreon show has literally become, like, we still find weird stuff that's hard to find, but so much of the shit that I have been like, well, I've always wanted to see Singing Ringing Tree. Fuck, it's on Tubi. And, like, there is so much stuff that I'm like, that I had been searching for, and it just pops up there. And then I'm like, Wait, it's on Tubi. And yeah,
It's
wild, wild.
amazing.
I love it. I will watch all of the diaper commercials they want to throw at me if they're going to keep finding these weird, hard to find giallos in there and stuff like that.
Yes, they have an amazing collection. This thing I'm going to mention isn't, it's moody horror. And it's called Alice or the Last Escapade by Claude Chabrol.
Oh, no, I don't know that one. I've
And
seen quite a few
this is
Chabrols,
an
yeah.
adult Alice in Wonderland retelling, but like a dark, fantastical, sexy version.
Wait, I was going to say, when you say adult, is this adult or is this just not for kids, Alice in Wonderland?
Not adult with a triple X or
Yeah.
anything,
Okay,
but adult in that
I've
it
seen
is there's
adult, like,
sexuality in it.
got it.
But very, I mean, so elegantly made, like beautifully. The version that's on Tubi isn't great, but I can kind of understand what it really would look like if it was properly transferred. Beautiful. I mean, beautifully composed, very moody, very Lynchian,
Yeah.
surreal, dreamy. Not for everyone, but something I had absolutely never heard of, and I was very pleasantly
Also, I
surprised
haven't
by
seen
it. That
him
was
do something
beautiful.
quite in that lane. He had there's a somewhat dreamy quality, but his films are all such Hitchcock De Palma-esque movies for the most part. So that sounds interesting.
You'll feel the Hitchcock in it,
Yeah.
but it's Hitchcock by way of Jean Cocteau or something.
Okay.
Like there's a
Ooh.
little bit of magic realism going on. It's really lovely. The other thing that I stumbled on at not on Tubi, unfortunately, but I just thought was so extraordinary, which isn't strictly horror, but certainly has horrific moments, is On a Silver Globe
Oh yeah, Zulowski, yeah.
by Andrzej. I guess the it's is it Zelowski or
I mean, he's
Jalowski is the
Polish,
Polish
so it'd be yeah,
pronunciation,
Vods is Lods,
something
and
like that. But I thought, it's like one of those tortured films which was ripped away from the filmmaker's hands before he finished it, because it was, in communist Poland at the time, and the authorities didn't care for him. And so it was sort of sat on a shelf. It was made in 1977, and then he came, but he got it back, and he sort of finished it by just shooting shots of people walking around Warsaw, and then would narrate the parts that he never got to make. And I kind of like it. Like, I'm sure it was torture for him, but there's something amazing about this wild science fiction film where we go into the present, and it's so surreal. And I'm going to have to, on that note, science fiction surrealism, I'm afraid
That no, that's
I gotta
okay.
run.
That is okay. No, we have kids. We totally
Zulowski
get
is a
it.
good one to end on because that also has about 40 minutes of the best found footage sequence I've ever seen. Put committed to film. It's all from the camera's point of view, and it takes your breath away. It's so intense. And
Oh, well, thank you so much for joining us tonight, Vincenzo. I know you have to run, but we have had the best time talking with you. So we're going to have to get you back
yeah, we'll do
on
it again.
soon so we can keep geeking out about
We'll
Zulowski.
just talk
So,
about
yes, please.
we did your movies this time. We'll just talk about movies we love next time. And
Just movies we love next
yeah.
time, or good graphic novels, because I rarely get to talk about graphic novels. So I will always jump at that. So thank you so much. And y'all can tune into our Patreon in a couple of weeks for Alice in the Last Escapade, because I just
Oh
added
yeah.
it to my to-do list.
Yeah,
So that's going on deep
it's
cuts.
11 p.m. where he is. It's only 8 where we are, so
It's only 8. So anyway, thank you
you can squeeze
so
in on a
much
silver
for
glove.
joining us.
Yeah, exactly.
All good.
It's only 3.5 hours.
3.5, yeah.
Okay, guys.
Thanks.
I'll get that by the
So
time
good
I
to
have to
see you.
get
I'm
up.
so sorry I'm
Don't
running out
worry.
on
Don't
you. Don't worry.
no
We'll reach out
worry.
soon.
Have a good one. Thank you all so much for tuning into our show this evening. If you need more weirdness, you can find us over at our Patreon show, Deep Cuts. And we will be back in another 2 weeks with something weird and wonderful here on the regular show as well. Thank you all so much. Have a fantastic day. The Colors of the Dark podcast is a Fangoria production. Producers and co-hosts are Rebecca McKendry and Elric Kane. Executive producers are Tara Ainsley and Abby Gould. Sonic branding by Michael Rodriguez. And, of course, our amazing sound engineer, Ernie Hurtado.